Chapter 5. Big Mountain, Montana. The old man pushed off from the chairlift and skied with strong skating steps to the top of Black Diamond Run. He paused at the brow of the hill, and his cobalt eyes took in the panoramic sweep of sky and mountain. From 7,000 feet, he had an eagle's eye view of the Flathead Valley and Whitefish Lake. The snowy peaks of Glacier National Park glistened in the east. Stretching out to the north were the jagged teeth of the Canadian Rockies. No fog shrouded the bald summit. Not a wisp of cloud marred the luminous blue sky. As the warm sunlight toasted his face, he reflected on the debt he owed the mountains. There was no doubt in his mind. Without the clarity offered by the brooding peaks, he would have gone insane. When World War II ended, Europe began to pull itself back together, but his mind was a jungle full of dark murmurings. No matter that he had lent his deadly skills to the cause of the resistance, he was still a robotic killer. Worse, he had a fatal defect: humanity. Like any fine-tuned machine with a flawed mechanism, in time he would have flown apart. He had left the war-ravaged continent for New York and pushed west until he was thousands of miles from the smoldering European slaughterhouse. He had built a simple log house, cutting and hewing each log with hand tools. The back-breaking labor and the pure air cleansed the shadowed recesses of his memory. The violent nightmares became less frequent. He could sleep without a gun under his pillow and a knife strapped to his thigh. With the passage of years, he had evolved from a remorseless, polished killing machine into an aging ski bum. The close-cropped blonde hair of his youth had turned to a pewter gray that now grew over his ears. A shaggy mustache matched his wild eyebrows. His pale features had become as weathered as buckskin. As he squinted against the sun-sparkled snow, a smile came to his long-jawed face. He was not a religious man. He could not muster enthusiasm for a maker who would create something as absurd as man. If he chose a religion, it would be Druidism, because it made as much sense to worship an oak tree as any deity. At the same time, he regarded each trip to the top of the mountain as a spiritual experience. This would be the last run of the season. The snow had held late into the spring as it did at higher altitudes, but the light, fluffy champagne powder of the winter had given way to wet, heavy corn. Patches of exposed brown earth showed through the thin cover, and the smell of damp earth hung in the air. He adjusted his goggles and pushed off with his poles, shushing straight down the North Bowl face to gain speed before initiating his first turn. He always started his day with the same trail, a fast bowl run that wound in between silent snow ghosts. Strange, phantasmagoric creatures that formed when cold and fog coated trees with rime. He made the smooth, effortless turns he had learned as a child in Kitzbühel, Austria. At the bottom of the bowl, he shot down Schmidt's chute and into a glade. Except for the most dedicated skiers and boarders, most people had hung up their skis to work on their boats and fishing gear. It seemed that he was the master of the mountain. But as Schrader broke out of the trees into the open, two skiers emerged from a copse of fir trees. They skied a few hundred feet behind him, one on either side of the trail. He moved at the same steady pace, making short radius turns that would give the newcomers room. Instead of passing, they matched him turn for turn until they were skiing three abreast. A long, dormant mental radar kicked on. Too late. The skiers closed on him like the jaws of a pair of pliers. The old man pulled over to the edge of the trail. His escorts skidded to hockey stops in sprays of snow, one above him and the other below. Their muscular physiques pushed tightly against the fabric of their identical one-piece silver suits. Their faces were hidden by their mirrored goggles. Only their jaws were visible. The men stared at him without speaking. They were playing a game of silent intimidation. He showed his teeth in an alligator smile. Morning, he said cheerfully in the Western accent he had cultivated through the years. They don't make days better than this. The uphill skier said in a slow southern drawl, You're Carl Schrader, if I'm not mistaken. The name he had discarded decades before sounded shockingly alien to his ears, but he held his smile. I'm afraid you are mistaken, friend. My name is Svensson. Arne Svensson. Taking his time, the skier planted his ski poles into snow, removed one glove, reached inside his suit, and extracted a PPK Walther pistol. Let's not play games, Arne. We've authenticated your identity with fingerprints.
Impossible.
I'm afraid you've confused me with someone else. The man chuckled. Don't you remember? We were standing behind you at the bar. The old man combed his memory and recalled an incident at the hell-roaring saloon, the après-ski watering hole at the bottom of the mountain. He had been pounding down beers as only an Austrian can. He had come back to his stool from a restroom break and found his half-filled beer mug had vanished. The bar was busy, and he assumed another customer had mistakenly walked off with his drink. The beer mug, he said. That was you. The man nodded. We watched you for an hour, but it was worth the wait. You left us a full set of fingerprints. We've been on your ass ever since. The shush-shush of skis came from up trail. Don't do anything stupid, said the man, glancing uphill. He covered the gun with his gloved hand. A moment later, a lone skier flew by in a blur and disappeared down the trail without slowing. Schrader had known that his transformation from cold-blooded warrior to human being would leave him vulnerable. But he had come to believe that his new identity had successfully insulated him from his old life. The gun pointed at his heart was persuasive evidence to the contrary. What do you want? Schrader said. He spoke with the world-weariness of a fugitive who had been run to ground. I want you to shut up and do what I say. They tell me you're an ex-soldier, so you know how to follow orders. Some soldier, the other man said with undisguised scorn. All I see from here is an over-the-hill guy crapping his pants. They both laughed. Good. They knew he had been in the military, but he guessed they didn't know that he had graduated from one of the world's most notorious killing schools. He had kept his martial arts and marksmanship skills honed, and although he was pushing 80, constant physical exercise and strenuous outdoor pursuits had maintained a body many men half his age would have envied. He remained calm and confident. They would be on his turf, where he knew every tree and boulder. I was a soldier a long time ago. Now I'm just an old man. He lowered his head, hunching his shoulders to project an attitude of submission, and injected a tremor into his deep voice. We know a lot more about you than you think, said the man with a gun. We know what you eat, where you sleep. We know where you and your mutt live. They had been in his house. Where the mutt used to live, said the other man. He stared at the man. You killed my dog? Why? Your little wiener wouldn't stop yapping. We gave him a pill to shut him up. The friendly little female dachshund he had named Shotsky was probably barking because she was glad to see the intruders. A coldness seemed to flow into his body. In his mind, he heard his classroom mentor, Professor Hines. The cherubic psychopath with the kindly blue eyes had been rewarded with a teaching sinecure at the Wevelsberg Monastery for his work designing the Nazi death machine. In skilled hands, nearly any ordinary object can be a lethal weapon, the professor was saying in his soft-spoken voice. The hard end of this newspaper, rolled into a tight coil, can be used to break a man's nose and drive the bone splinters into his brain. This fountain pen can penetrate the eye and cause death. This metal wristwatch band worn across the knuckles is capable of breaking facial bones. This belt makes a wonderful garrote if you can't quickly remove your bootlaces. Schrader's grip tightened on the pole handles. I'll do whatever you say, he said. Maybe we can work this out. Sure, the man said with the flicker of a smile. First, I want you to ski slowly to the base of the mountain. Follow my dog-loving friend. He's got a gun, too. I'll be right behind you. At the end of the run, take your skis off, stick them in the rack, and walk to the east parking lot. May I ask where you're taking me? We're not taking you anywhere. We're delivering you. Think of us like FedEx or UPS, the other man said. His companion said, nothing personal, just business. Move it. Nice and easy. He gestured with the gun, then he tucked it back into his suit so he could ski unhindered. With the downhill man in the lead and Schrader in the middle, they skied the trail single file at a moderate speed. Schrader sized up the man ahead as an aggressive skier whose muscle partly made up for his lack of technical skill. He glanced back at the other man and guessed from his free-form technique that he was the less accomplished skier. Still, they were young and strong, and they were armed. A snowboarder flew by and disappeared down the trail. Gambling that his escort would reflexively glance at the moving object, Schrader made his move. He made a wide turn, but instead of traversing, he spun his body around 180 degrees so that he was facing uphill. His escort didn't see the maneuver until it was too late. He tried to stop. Schrader jammed his downhill ski into the snow. He grasped his right ski pole with both hands, letting the other pole hang by its strap, and drove the steel tip into the small, fleshy part of the man's neck above the turtleneck. The man was still moving when the tip punched a ragged hole in his throat below the Adam's apple. He let out a wet gurgle, his legs went out from under him, and he crashed to the snow where he writhed in terrible agony. Schrader sidestepped the flailing body like a matador evading a stricken bull. The lead man glanced over his shoulder. Schrader yanked back his improvised spear. He dug his poles in and swooped down the trail. He drove his right elbow into the man's cheek and knocked him off balance. With knees bent and head low in a tuck, he shushed straight down the trail until he neared the bottom of the run where the trail made a sharp turn to the right. The second skier must have been carrying a machine pistol under his jacket because the burp of automatic gunfire shattered the mountain stillness. The shots harmlessly shredded the overhead tree branches. A second later, Schrader was safely out of the line of fire. He turned onto a narrow, double-black expert run that twisted down the side of the mountain like a corkscrew. The ski patrol had strung yellow tape and put up a sign saying the trail was closed. Schrader ducked under the tape. The trail dropped into an almost vertical run. The snow had a brownish tinge, showing that the cover was thin. The surface was broken by large patches of bare ground. Rocks that normally lay under the snow base were exposed. He heard gunfire behind him, and miniature fountains of mud erupted a few feet away. The shooter was at the top of the ridge, firing down. Schrader slalomed between bare ground and rocks. His skis hit slush and almost ground to a stop, but there was just enough of a skim coat to allow the skis to keep sliding. Schrader wove his way through a field of short moguls and got onto a steep pitch where the snow cover was adequate. He heard gunshots off to his right. His pursuer was skiing down a trail that was parallel to Schrader's, firing through the glade that separated them. Most of the shots hit trees. The gunman saw that he was missing his mark and went into the woods, separating the two trails. The man's form resembled a kangaroo on steroids, but he powered his way through the woods in leaps and bounds. Schrader saw that the man would break out of the trees below him, where he could rake the trail with killing gunfire. The man fell once and quickly got back on his skis. The delay would give Schrader time to ski past the gunman before he broke back into the open. He'd still be an easy target. Instead, As the gunman broke from the woods on the side of the trail, Schrader charged down on him. The man saw Schrader hurtling at him and fumbled for his gun under his suit. Schrader slashed with his ski pole at the man's exposed face like a Cossack on a rampage. The blow went high and smashed the man's goggles. He lost his balance, skiing first on one ski, then the other. The gun flew out of his hand. Weaving drunkenly, arms flailing, he pitched over the edge of the trail where it dropped down steeply for about 20 feet into the woods. He ended up upside down in the snow depression around the trunk of a large fir tree. His skis were tangled in the lower branches. He struggled to get out of his bindings, but they were out of reach. He hung there helplessly. His breathing was labored. Schrader sidestepped his way down the slope. He picked the Uzi out of the snow where the man had dropped the weapon and held it loosely in one hand. "Who are you working for?" Schrader said. The man managed to push his smashed goggles onto his head. "Acme Security," the man said, speaking with effort. "Acme?" Schrader said with a smile. "They're a big outfit down in Virginia." "You knew who I was. You must have known why they wanted me." The man shook his head. "What were you going to do with me?" "We were going to deliver you to people at the bottom of the mountain. There was supposed to be a car waiting." "You've been watching me for days. You know more than you're saying." "Tell me what they said," he said soothingly. "I give you my word. I won't kill you. See?" He flung the Uzi into the woods. A suspicious expression came to the man's face, but he decided to take his chances. "There was something about a girl's picture we found in your house. They think you know where she is." "Why do they want her?" "I don't know." Schrader nodded. "One more thing. Who killed Schatzky?" "Who?" The man looked at Schrader as if he were insane. "My little dachshund. The noisy wiener dog." "My partner killed him." "But you didn't stop him." "I like dogs." "I believe you." Schrader backed off and began to herringbone up the slope. "You can't leave me here," the man shouted with panic in his voice. Schrader stopped. "I only said I wouldn't kill you. I never said I would pull you out." "Don't worry. I'm sure they'll find you when the snow melts." The temperature would drop down to zero that night. The human body's vital organs were not meant to function upside down, and the man would probably die soon from suffocation. Schrader skied to the base of the mountain to a spot that offered a view of the parking lot. He picked out the black Yukon SUV with the tinted windows. 3 men stood beside it, looking up the mountain. He wondered who they were, but decided it didn't matter. For now. He removed his skis, left them on a rack, and went to the locker room. He grabbed his fanny pack, stuck the boots in the locker, quickly changed into his walking shoes, and headed to the lot where he had parked his truck. Schrader checked out the lot and saw nothing suspicious. He walked quickly to the truck and got in. As he drove out of the parking lot, he reached under the seat for a pistol and placed it in his lap. He contemplated his next move. It would be dangerous to go back to his house. He headed out of town toward Glacier National Park. 20 minutes later, he pulled up in front of a small, ramshackle building. The sign outside said, "Glacier Park Wilderness Touring Company and Camps." It was one of a number of businesses and real estate holdings Schrader had invested in using straw companies. Behind the building were several camps he rented out in the warm season. He parked behind the building, went inside a cabin he reserved for his own use, and removed a moth-eaten moose head from over the fireplace to reveal a wall safe. He opened the safe with a few twists of the combination lock. Inside was a strong box stuffed with cash, which he jammed into his parka pockets, along with fake driver's licenses, passports, and credit cards. Schrader went into the bathroom and shaved off his mustache. He tinted his hair brown to match the picture in his ID, and from a closet he pulled a pre-packed suitcase. The change of identity took less than 30 minutes. Haste was of the essence. Anyone who could find a way through the web of fake identities that he had woven had to have considerable resources. It was only a matter of time before they tracked down the wilderness camps. Someone might be watching the small airport in Kalispell. He decided to drive to Missoula and rent a car. Halfway to his destination, he stopped at a payphone. Using a phone card, he called a long-distance number. As the phone rang, he held his breath, wondering if she would even remember him. It had been a long time. A man answered. They exchanged a few words and hung up. There was disappointment in his eyes. Montana has no speed limit. As Schrader pushed the truck to its limits, he wondered how the genie had once again escaped from the bottle. He was much younger the first time it had been contained, and he wondered if, at his age, he was still up to it. He thought about the girl. Her portrait in his bedroom was taken by a commercial studio. They could trace it back. He thought his computer files were clean, but one could never tell. Then there were the phone records. He had grown careless in his old age. It was only a matter of time before they found her. He wondered what she looked like. The last time he had seen her was at her grandfather's funeral. He let his mind drift back, recalling the events that linked him to the young woman. It was 1948. He was living in his log cabin in Montana. Although he had access through Swiss bank accounts to vast amounts of money, he eked out a living doing odd jobs and guiding tourists through Glacier National Park. One client, a businessman from Detroit, had left a magazine in his cabin. Schrader did all the cleanup work himself, and he had glanced idly through its pages. That's when he discovered what had happened to Laszlo Kovács since the night the Wilhelm Gustloff went to the bottom. The magazine article described a company set up by Dr. Janos, an enterprising World War II Hungarian refugee. His corporation was bringing an innovative array of consumer products to the market, all based on electromagnetic properties, making him a millionaire in the process. Schrader smiled. There was no photograph of the reclusive inventor, but the Kovács genius came through on every item. It was the mud season in between skiing and trekking, so one day he packed a bag and took the train to Detroit. He found the Janos lab in an unmarked building. He had to ask several people in the neighborhood where the lab was. He watched the front door from a parked car. The patience he had learned when stalking human beings was eventually rewarded. A Cadillac limousine pulled up to the building. Instead of stopping in front, it went around to an alley in the back. It took off before he could see who got in the car. He followed the car to the exclusive Grosse Pointe section of Detroit, where many auto executives lived. He lost the limo when it went through the gate of a walled estate. The next afternoon, he was at the lab again. He parked where he had a clear view of the back alley. When the limo showed up, he got out of his car and walked over to the alley. The chauffeur, who was holding the door open, glanced at him, but probably thought Schrader was a bum to be ignored. A man emerged from the back door and walked to the limo. He glanced in Schrader's direction, started to get in the car, then he looked again. A wide grin came to his face. To the puzzlement of the limo driver, his wealthy employer went over and put his arms around the bum in a great hug. After all these years, what in God's name are you doing here? Kovács said. I thought you might like to take a ride in the snow, Schrader said with a grin. Kovács responded with a look of mock horror. Not if you are at the wheel. You are looking well, old friend.
Yes, you too.
Different, however.
I wasn't sure at first.
But it's the same old Carl. I shouldn't have come here, Schrader said.
Please, my friend, it was fated that we would meet again. I have so much to thank you for.
Knowing that you are well and prosperous is thanks enough. Now,
I must go. We must talk first, Kovacs said. He told his driver to wait and led the way back into the lab. There is no one here, he said. They passed through lab rooms filled with electrical contraptions that would have been at home in Frankenstein's lab and settled in a luxurious office. You've done well, Schrader said. I'm glad to see that. I've been very fortunate. And you? I am happy, although my home isn't as rich-looking as yours. You've been to my house? Of course. I should have known. You touch all the bases, as they say in our adopted country. You have a family? A cloud passed over Kovacs's brow, but then he smiled. Yes, I remarried. And you? There have been many women, but I continue to be a loner. Most unfortunate. I'd like to introduce you to my wife and daughter. Schrader shook his head. This was as far as it goes, he said. Kovacs said he understood. Schrader's presence would raise too many questions. Both of them still had enemies in the world. They talked for another hour until Schrader finally asked the question that had been on his mind. I assume you have buried the frequencies. Kovacs tapped his forehead. Up here, now and forever. You are aware that there was an attempt to capitalize on your work. The Russians found material at the lab and tried to make it work for them. Kovacs smiled. I am like the aunt who writes down her cookie recipe for the family, but leaves out an important ingredient. Their experiments would have taken them only so far. They tried. Our adopted country conducted similar research once the government found out what was going on. Then the experiments stopped. There is no need to worry. I haven't forgotten what my work did to my first family. Satisfied with the answer, Schrader said he had to go. They shook hands and embraced. Schrader gave Kovacs an address to get in touch with him if needed. They vowed to talk again, but years passed without contact. Then one day Schrader checked his blind box and found a message from the Hungarian. I need your help again, the message said. When he called, the scientist said, Something terrible has happened. This time Schrader went directly to the Grosse Pointe mansion. Kovacs greeted him at the door. He looked terrible. He had aged well, the only visible change a graying of his hair, but there were dark circles under his eyes, and his voice was hoarse, as if he had been crying. They sat in the study, and Kovacs explained that his wife had died a few years before. Their son had married a wonderful woman, he said, but they were both killed in a car crash a few weeks before. When Schrader offered his condolences, Kovacs thanked him and said there was one way he could help. He spoke into an intercom, and a few minutes later a nursemaid came in. She was holding a beautiful, blonde baby girl. My granddaughter, Carla, Kovacs said, proudly taking the baby. She is named after an old friend who, I hope, will soon be her godfather. He handed the baby to Schrader, who held her awkwardly in his arms. Schrader was touched by the invitation and accepted the responsibility. As the girl grew up, he made several trips to Grosse Pointe, where he was referred to as Uncle Carl, and had become entranced by her grace and intelligence. On one occasion, she and her grandfather had spent several days in Montana. They were sitting on the porch of his log cabin, watching the girl chasing butterflies, when Kovacs revealed that he had a fatal illness. I am going to die soon. My granddaughter is well provided for. But I want you to pledge that you will watch over her as you once watched over me and protect her from all harm. It will be my pleasure, Schrader said, never dreaming that one day he would have to honor his pledge. The last time he had seen Carla was at her grandfather's funeral. She had started college and was busy with studies and friends. She had developed into a lovely and intelligent young woman. He checked in with her from time to time to make sure she was well and followed her career with pride. It had been years since they had seen each other. He wondered if she would recognize him. He clenched his teeth in renewed determination. Whatever it took, he knew he must get to her before they did.